Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Stacey Thomas about her historical novel, The Revels. Stacey is a civil servant and a staff writer at Bad Form Review. She was awarded the Claire McIntosh Scholarship for Black Writers in 2021, and she was one of the three winners of HarperCollins' Killing It competition for undiscovered writers. In this episode, we discuss adding a touch of fantasy to historical fiction, her advice for making historical settings feel lived in, and what happens when other books come out that sound similar to yours. But before we get into that, here's Stacey with an excerpt from The Revels.
Anne Greer resides in a medium-sized limestone cottage. The house is neat, with a small herb garden near the entrance, soon trampled by the horses of Rush and his men. The windows have been broken. The damage is not recent, for the lattice is veiled with cloth. This does little to keep us out. Rush, Clements, Will and Mrs. Barnett barge inside to begin the investigations, leaving myself and Rush's watchers, Henry, Water and Samuel, to stand in wait, lest Mrs. Greer's familiars come to her aid. "Have you ever seen a witch before?" Henry asks, every time I catch sight of my reflection. "No." "We shall all see them by the night's end," Henry brags, and then straightens up at Mrs. Barnett's appearance. Her apron pocket is bulky from the sweet bags of jasmine and the coins that jingle with each step. Water helps her onto her horse. "A witch mark was found," she volunteers. "Where?" asks Samuel, but she is not inclined to linger and kicks her horse into a canter. By itself, the devil's mark is not enough to secure a conviction. A confession is needed, and I turn to see Clement stood on the door threshold. I do not wait for him to beckon me close, and instead hurry inside to prepare to claim, by a lucky throw of the dice, my prize. Mrs. Greer is sitting in the middle of the room, her limbs bound to the chair with rope. She raises her head, and I am afforded her grudging recognition. My eyes linger on everything but her. The room has been cleared, with most of the furniture pushed towards the corners. A cat mews, but keeps itself hidden. Rush's watcher commandeers place for themselves in the corner, and Mrs. Greer's feet grind into the floor in silent protest at the familiar way they handle her belongings. The men bask in her disapproval and scrape their mud-splattered boots on the rugs. Will and Rush are sitting next to each other in the corner, their expressions veiled by shadows. "Nicholas is to lead," Clements reminds Rush when he attempts to banish me to the reader's desk in the corner. The table is empty apart from an inkpot, quill and paper. I resist the urge to make it my shield. "The circumstances call for experience," says Rush. "I am experienced. I have trained under Judge Percival," I argue. "To do anything else would arouse the witch hunter's suspicions and see Althamia in Mrs. Greer's place." "I will guide him if he missteps," says Will, with a look of encouragement. while Clements finishes. He has earned this.
Hi, Stacey. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Rebels.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
So can you start by giving us an introduction to The Rebels and telling us what it's all about?
Yes. So The Rebels is set during the English Civil War, and it follows a young man, Nicholas Pierce, who's apprenticed to an infamous former witch hunter. The only problem is that he's a witch himself who can hear the dead sing. And my story is all about him trying to survive while getting drawn into an increasingly gruesome witch hunt and finding love for the first time. As you can tell, I've had plenty of time to practice that pitch.
You have. I'm always in awe of authors who can just roll out their pitch perfectly, and that's so brilliant. Where did the title come from? Because I just love that title. Though I always love the title. Obviously my book's got the title, but I'm always always attracted to a the something. So where did The Rebels come from?
So basically, originally, like, with my main character, he's an aspiring playwright, but like originally he wanted to be an actor. And so when I was like researching like 17th century England, I realized that there was a post called Master of Revels. And so he was basically in charge of deciding which plays could be performed in front of like the royal court. And so that's where I got the idea for the title, because within my book, it's kind of like, I kind of liken the witch trials and kind of the persecutions to a play, because it's that thing people are kind of getting off on the kind of theatrical aspect of it. And so I thought that like The Rebels would have been like a perfect kind of like starting point for the title. And then as you kind of get into the book, like one of my characters is kind of likened to the Master of Rebels because of the kind of power they have in like shaping the narrative. But originally, like, I was kind of going back and forth between like The Rebels, The Revelers, or like Dark Rebels, and then I just decided on like The Rebels. And luckily, like neither my agent or editor ever suggested like changing it, so
it just felt right. Are you a person that finds titles like easy, or do they take a while to come to you?
I feel like because when I first started writing, like, I feel like I was kind of so focused on getting the first line, I didn't really think about the title. And then as I'm writing, I kind of tend to maybe obsess over it. So sometimes I feel like with The Rebels, like, the title came quite easy. And then with the second book, I was trying to come up with all these kind of complicated titles. Like, I'm still working on book two. And then it's like the title, like, I have, which, you know, agent or editor could decide to change, but it's like it's quite kind of simple, but like it gets to the heart of like what's it about. So but again, like, it might change.
I really find titles difficult, so I bow down to your title skills there. So your novel is historical, but there's a slight fantastical element in the sense that Nicholas can hear the voices of the dead, and well, it's more like songs from the dead, because they come out in this very poetic way. How did you handle that fantastical element in a historical world? And was that your starting point for the novel, or did it come from somewhere else?
So I would say, like, I always wanted to have that supernatural aspect, because even though, like, with my book, like, it's quite, like, I base, like, a lot of the events on, like, things that have happened, so where I can, I've tried to be, you know, authentic, like, as authentic as possible as you can be in a book where the dead sing. But then it's kind of like it was a balancing act, because when I went on submission to agents, and like I got my agent Liza de Block at Mushins, I just remembered she kind of wanted a bit more world building with that fantastical aspect. And then when I handed in the first round of edits, she was like, okay, this is kind of going more into the historical fantasy, and we want it to be more historical fiction. So it was kind of just scaling it back. And so I kind of just feel like with the kind of like the supernatural fantasy element, that was kind of, because it was kind of wrapped up in Nicholas's personal development, in a way it made it easier, because even though it was part of like the story, like the fantasy story wasn't the story, it was always the kind of the witch trials and trying to stop it. And because in my book, like, apart from Nicholas, there's only one or two people who have powers, so again, it's kind of like, it's not that kind of, you know, like magical realism kind of book where the magic is like kind of propelling the story along. It's basically about kind of, what kind of people do in the search for powers and the different weapons they have, like, whether it's like kind of power or like, magic or just, whatever other weapons they can wield.
Were you happy to kind of go down the more historical route rather than the fantasy route, or did that kind of come as a bit of a, I was going to say a surprise, but I wonder whether there was any kind of feeling from you that you thought, I don't really know how to balance it, or I don't really know what I want this book to be, or did you feel like you definitely wanted to go down the historical fiction route with a kind of sprinkle of magic?
I feel like I always want to go down the historical fiction route with just a sprinkle of like magic, because I've read like a lot of historical fantasy and fantasy books, and as much as I love them, I just feel like, oh God, they're too much work. Like, it's just like I'm really in awe of the magical world building, but when you go into the kind of pure fantasy books where it's a completely different world and a made up language, I'm just like, I don't have the brain capacity for this. I'd love to, but like I can't. I'm sorry. So I feel like if we had gone down that road, it's kind of like, I feel like in a way maybe it wouldn't have been the right decision, because it's kind of like if I was kind of branded as a kind of fantasy author, then it would just mean for my second book, it's kind of like it would have to kind of be similar, and it's kind of like that's not the direction I want to go in, especially when I just think about my future ideas are a lot more kind of historical, where it's like I always just want that little kind of sliver of kind of magic, but not kind of completely kind of all out fantasy.
Yeah, I'm going to pull you up on that though, because I read an interview that said that you were intimidated by historical fiction, and I just wondered, like, okay, you were slightly worried about writing historical fiction. How did you get past that? How did you think to yourself, okay, well, this is what I really want to write, but I'm worried about writing it. Maybe I'm not good enough. I think we all feel that though. I think whatever genre we pick, there's a part of us that thinks, am I that person? Am I that writer? So how did you get past that feeling of, I'm not a historical fiction writer, or I'm not capable of doing it?
I feel like I got past it because, like, originally, like, I grew up, like, reading like historical fiction and watching period dramas, so it's always been my first love. And I kind of just felt like, obviously, with the amount of work involved in like researching, historical fiction, I was always just too scared to try. So it was only when my first book, which was like a contemporary kind of like YA with like fantasy elements, when that died on submission, I realized that, I didn't really have anything to lose. Like, if I wanted to write, then I needed to kind of, write in the genre that I've always loved. And it was during lockdown, so it's that thing, it's like I didn't have any distractions. I had more time to just really kind of, give it a go. And so I feel like it was just that thing, it's like you'll never like succeed if you don't try. So for me, it was kind of like I kind of just had this mindset where it's like I'm just going to go for it, and if it doesn't work out, then it doesn't work out, but like I have to try.
Definitely. I'm going to touch on a bit more about your kind of your first venture into querying agents a bit later, but I just want to go back to the novel and talk a little bit more about Nicholas's character and how did you come up with him as a character? What kind of work did you do to make him into your kind of into your main character?
Oh wow. So with like the first book I wrote, I kind of had footnotes in the vein of like Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And so with one of the footnotes, I kind of delved into the kind of English witch trials. And because I had like a male kind of protagonist for my first book, I feel like because that had failed, I was kind of like, okay, maybe like that story and that genre doesn't work, but maybe I can kind of take that male character and kind of just see like if I can kind of work it into a new story. So even though Nicholas is a completely kind of different character, I've kind of got that same kind of I've there are similarities in that both characters have powers, and they also kind of have securities on having powers in a world where like it's not, accepted. And I kind of just feel like because I studied at Curtis Brown, like creative like writing school. And so when I started that course, I was 10,000 words in, which, at the time I was kind of panicking because like there were some people in the course who had already finished their novels. But then I feel like perhaps one of the blessings of starting with the lower word count was that I was able to kind of slow down and with the help of my tutors, like really figure out the story like I wanted to tell. And so they really kind of helped me to kind of develop the character and then just also kind of, ask myself the questions to kind of really kind of, figure out who Nicholas was. And so I feel like for me, like when I was kind of just going through edits and like reading my story over and over again, I was constantly just asking myself questions like, okay, why is he acting like this? Like, why is he interacting with these characters? And like that kind of constant motivation question, okay, what does he want overall? What does he want in this scene? And seeing where it went.
Brilliant. And again, I'm gonna ask you more about the CBC stuff later. But I want to ask one question about your kind of the reveal of the magic, really, as such.
Yes.
Because obviously that moment is so pivotal. But I wondered when reading it whether you came at that scene already knowing that it was going to be that moment that you had it envisioned in your mind, exactly when Nicholas's power or skill was going to be revealed, or whether you kind of played with holding it back for longer or revealing it in a different way or revealing it at the beginning. Like, how did you decide when to reveal that moment?
Oh God, so there was a lot of back and forth on that, especially like when I was like working with my agent and editor. So I believe before I went on submission to agents, I kind of had that reveal like in that kind of moment of the book, or maybe like a chapter or two earlier. And then I remembered when I was going through edits with my agent, she wanted to make it clear of the magical ability from the beginning. And then when I went through edits with my editor, she actually wanted to delay that reveal. And it's like I remember like my agent and I kind of like laughing over it because it was just that thing. You just realized like how subjective this whole thing was. Like, because it's just that thing, like what one person might like, another person, it's like it's not like for them in that way. And it's kind of like it is definitely a balancing act. And I do feel that with my kind of agent and editor, like obviously they were giving me kind of edits and their feedback, but I always felt like I had control over how I wanted to shape the story. But then I also just feel like I'm quite, naturally collaborative and I'll take on like feedback. And because I wanted the story to be as strong as it could be, like I had no problem in kind of going back and making those changes, even though sometimes it's like it's painful because of that kind of ripple effect. So you're just, oh God, yeah, it's sort of like a dance in a way. You're just trying to make it all kind of, clean and like elegant. But I feel like perhaps having that experience of playing around, it just made me kind of see like the ways in which I can kind of heighten kind of like, the tension. And like when you kind of read the book, it's sort of that thing. It's like it helped me to kind of develop Stephen's character, who was kind of a father figure to Nicholas. And so at first you just think, oh, he doesn't want to be apprenticed to this man because he'll see it as a betrayal of, Stephen's. And then you realize later, oh, there's something else not right here. And when I think back to the stories I've read, I kind of always like it when like the character has a secret or two kind of up their sleeve. So it kind of just taught me like how to kind of improve as a writer. And like it just made me remember what I really like kind of to read as a reader as well, in terms of like those kind of like those reveal moments.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've nailed that kind of difficulty of deciding what is the right decision, because like you say, it's so subjective, and you could make a scene at the beginning or 5 chapters in and one person says, oh, move the scene to beginning, and the other person says, no, move it in chapter 5, and you as the writer have ultimately got to make that decision and kind of hope for the best it's the right one, which is always that pressure, I think, but only you know kind of really where it should be. I wondered whether you could tell us a little bit more about your research. I know you are, incredibly passionate about this era in history, and you know so much, just I can tell you know so much just by reading your book. How did you manage to kind of weave it into the narrative without, because obviously there's always going to be things that you want to reveal in the book that you've read in your research, but you know, there's probably too much research to fit into the book. So how did you kind of decide what was going to be kept, what was going to be on the cutting room floor, and was that difficult to decide?
God, it was like really difficult because I feel like what I really struggled with when I was going through the research was trying to just figure out why the Civil War happened, because I read so many books and it's just that thing. It's like some people are like, oh, you know, it was King Charles. Other people, it was like, you know, more people are reading, like, so they're becoming more aware of, like, you know, their rights and inequality. And then I feel like for me, it's like I would have pages and pages of reasons why the war happened. And then it's kind of just that thing. It's like you just kind of, as you edit, you just kind of go through and you keep trying to reduce it and reduce it and reduce it until you have maybe just like two or three lines about that matter, so that it doesn't feel like a history textbook. But like it definitely is a struggle. And I think when I was just writing my story, it's kind of that thing. It's like if it wasn't kind of connected to the character or the storyline, then it's like I would just, like, you know, try to cut like as much as possible. And so I feel like one thing it's like I wanted to include, I really wanted to kind of include stuff about like the Levellers and, you know, those kind of freedom movements that were, those political movements that were coming up. But it was kind of like, because it wasn't part of the story, that it's like I just couldn't justify fitting it in. And because obviously there's so much like going on in that time, and I feel like with the witch trials they're complicated enough, so it was kind of like I was just trying to keep stuff that was directly relevant to the witch trials. But then obviously with the Civil War, like that was one of the reasons the hysteria happened, because, you know, because people are so distracted by the war, they're not really kind of, you know, they're not really kind of concerned about like the other stuff that's going on, so people are kind of taking advantage of the chaos. But yeah, it was just like, it is just it is a balancing act. And I feel like it's something like, even now I'm working on book two, I'm still kind of trying to kind of, you know, get it right in terms of, okay, when to include information and when to just leave it. And I feel like it's probably something you only get right as you go through kind of edits and you just kind of really get like a better handle of what the story is. And then you can kind of recognize, okay, this bit isn't necessary, cut.
Yeah, it's so difficult, isn't it? I'm always, anytime I speak to a historical fiction writer, I don't know how you do the level of research that's involved. You know, it's not just the kind of, like you say, trying to understand why the war happened, but it's things like names for certain things or what they eat or what they wear. And
yeah,
you have to have all those details to make, and your book is really beautifully written and vividly written. So you have to know all those details, don't you? Because you can't just write a scene where a character gets dressed or has a meal. You need to know every tiny little thing. And like, what do they eat with? What do they, you know, do they have, you know, bowls, or what is it they use to eat from?
Yeah,
to know all those details is, again, that's a hell of a lot of research you've got to do.
I know. It's just like at one point I did feel like I was just going insane, because when I just look at all the notes I took, and again, it's kind of like when you're doing that kind of research, like you'll only end up using like 10%, but it's kind of like you're just having to wade through all the information to find those kind of those core details. And
it's tough. But I wondered, apart from the kind of research side of it, what was the other kind of most challenging part of this novel, or writing this novel?
I feel like probably the most challenging part was probably just remembering that, you know, people are people regardless of the century they live in. And like, I feel like for me, like probably one of my kind of weaknesses as a writer is that sometimes like I can fall so deep into the research, like I lose sight of the story, and then it's kind of like, and I lose sight of the characters because I'm just kind of determined to bring the past to life. And it's like I just kind of forget, you know, that, you know, people are people. And so it's just that thing, it's like you kind of start to look at this past, the past is like this sort of like this alien kind of, you know, environment. And it's kind of like you have to like find those details that make it feel lived in a way.
Mm-hmm.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So you mentioned this other book, this YA book that you queried with before.
Yes.
And obviously that unfortunately didn't kind of attract interest of agents, but I wondered what it was about The Revels you think made it special, made it stand out for agents and to get that interest that you didn't get before.
I feel like, because even with the agents who didn't offer, they were all very complimentary about like the writing and the atmosphere. And I feel like probably, you know, what helped me to kind of, you know, like get a deal was basically the fact is like I was writing in a genre that, you know, that I actually, you know, that is my first love, because it's kind of like, it's embarrassing to admit, but like, you know, even though like I really like YA, like I probably wasn't really reading enough to have like written a story like, you know, in that, like in that genre. And it's kind of like, and certainly not enough to just be like, okay, like what can I do that will feel kind of fresh in this market? And so I feel like for me, it's like, perhaps for agents, they could see that like my love of the period kind of, you know, shone through, and so that I had this story and that I had more ideas for kind of like, you know, like other stories in the genre that wasn't just necessarily like a sequel. Whereas with the YA, like it was going to be like a duology or trilogy, and like that's probably because I didn't have any other ideas like that were like separate to that kind of book. And then I feel like with that, with The Revels, like I feel like I found like my voice, because like when I was growing up, like I'd always play, you know, when you're kind of role playing with your sisters and making up plays, they'd always be like these little period dramas. So like that kind of period speak, like, you know, that would kind of like, that kind of came like quite naturally, like when I found like the rhythm of my characters. And so even when I was editing, I could go back and I'd just be like, oh, okay, this is going into a bit of parody. Let's scale that back. But it's like I really loved, you know, how they spoke in that time period, and just like, you know, in the, when you're watching the films, like it does feel like a play, like with how people spoke, and like this is like slightly later, but like the especially the Georgian periods, when you just read some of their letters, like it's so kind of beautiful, but like no one speaks like that anymore. So I feel like for me, like I just really fell in love with the language of the period, and so that's what maybe helped me to kind of like tap into it. And then I think just having a male kind of witch was like quite a few agents really kind of like that fresh twist, and my editor, like, she really liked it as well, because she just said she could see witches were like becoming kind of popular, so she liked the fact that I had put like this fresh spin on it. And so like I feel like that's kind of what agents and editors are looking for. Sometimes it's not someone who's trying to kind of necessarily break the will, but just to kind of take what people love but like do it in a different way.
Absolutely. You've definitely hit the right time with witchy books. I've read a lot of witchy
Yeah.
this year, but yours is the only one with a male protagonist as far as I can remember.
Yeah, because it's funny, because when I was writing it, like I had no idea that witches were going to be so popular. It was just like an idea I had. And then it's kind of like when I was, I think at the beginning, like before I started writing, I went back and forth between having like a male character or like, female character. And I think the reason why I decided on a male character was because I wanted someone in my book who was going to have that male power, who could, ride into a town and kind of, demand things. So like to really kind of explore that male privilege in a way that a lot of women in that period, they didn't have, even if they were, like very wealthy, because, noble women were accused of being witches and also queens too. So yeah.
Yeah, I wondered, and this is a bit of a tangent, but I don't know whether you felt this when your book was being announced or kind of about to be announced, and you started to see other bookseller announcements of other books, and there would be ones that pop up and say, this is a story set in the 17th century about witchcraft, and you'd start to panic and be like, oh my goodness, my book is the same as this, or it's too similar. I had this with the book. And I think every single person I know has had that blind panic of, oh my goodness, my book's already been done. And I would just wonder whether you had that feeling, because obviously this is a time of lots of witchy books. Did you ever have that panic of, oh my goodness, like this book is, my book is not original enough, or it's already been taken somehow?
I feel like I did, because obviously, like when you were just seeing all those announcements, you're like, and like with a lot of them, they were being published before mine. So I was kind of like, oh God, my idea isn't original, and it's sort of like, people might read their books and it's like, and they'll decide that they're done with witches for a while. So it is, you do have that slight panic. But then when you just think about like, the whole Greek myth trend, it's kind of that thing. It's like I've read like quite a few books and like I've really like enjoyed them, but then it's kind of like it's not going to put me off reading more. I feel like for me, like what kind of, what I would look for is to see like what people are doing differently with that story. And so I would look for that fresh twist. And so I feel like I was quietly confident that I had enough of a twist that hopefully people would be drawn to it. But then it is just that kind of thing where it's like you want to be like original. So I know like in publishing, it's good when your book is easily like marketable and stuff. But then it's kind of like when you want to, I don't know, you still want to be original. You don't want to feel like you're kind of chasing a trend. But then it's just interesting like how these trends happen, because I'm sure like with a lot of people writing witch lit, like how many of them like predicted that witch that was going to be such a thing? Because yeah, you it's like it's just like getting your idea at the right time as well. It's
Yeah,
key.
that's really hard, because yeah, and I always think it's, it's that thing, isn't it, that people tend to be discouraged from kind of writing to a trend, because by the time your book's published, it will be 2 years later and the trend will have gone. And it's funny how people hit on a certain theme and then there are five other books published that year with a similar theme. But I mean, I do think, well, I've read a lot of witchy books this year, but they all seem to be pretty different and they're all quite distinct, which is, I mean, which is again why they're published. You're not asking for like identical books, but I do think people do have those nerves of, oh my goodness, my book's already been done. But we're all individuals, and there's no way that a book can be written as a kind of exact copy. So I think hopefully people won't feel that fear too much. One thing I really wanted to ask you about, because I just think what an amazing opportunity this must have been for you, was that you were mentored by Claire McIntosh.
Yes.
Incredible. What a dream. I wondered what was the most important thing that you learned from her.
I feel like, because basically, firstly, like, her is just so amazing. And it's like, I feel like when I first met her, I was like in awe of her books and her reputation. But then I feel like I was also just really kind of in awe of her kindness. Like, she is just really like so lovely and supportive. And I feel like the biggest lesson I got from her was that, obviously, with publishing, like, it is like a long game. And, you know, you have to work like incredibly hard, because even though she's traditionally published, you know, as you like say in interviews, she works in a way like an independently published author. So she's really like worked hard for her success. So it's just that thing, you just realize that in this industry, like, you know, unless you're really lucky, you'll have to just really kind of fight for what you want. So it just made me like try to kind of see publishing as a business, like, from the beginning. Because often, like, you know, you can spend years, like, you know, writing and hoping your book will get published, and then it's kind of like, and when you do, it's great, but then it's kind of like, it is that thing when you're turning your kind of dream into a job, or like, you know, trying to. And so it's a whole different kind of, you know, like, feeling to kind of, you know, navigate as well. Like, it's a journey in itself, in a way. So I feel like from Claire, I learned, you know, how to just be persistent, and then also definitely building like your writing tribe as well, because like she has such a strong network of, you know, authors, you know, like, who, you know, who they like, they all support each other. And I feel like for me, like, I've really kind of made an effort to kind of, you know, go to kind of different events and like, you know, kind of like, you know, meet and befriend other authors. And I also have like a really good like writing group, like a group of writers on Twitter, who I've, and it's like, it's been lovely, because it's like I've been able to meet like a few of them in person as well. And so I just realized, yeah, the writing community, like, it's key, like, just to kind of have support and like to kind of ask questions. And it's kind of like, you know, when you need to like panic over like, oh my god, I don't have an idea for book two, or it's like, oh, I have an idea, but it's like I don't know how to get started. And then you realize, like, yes, everyone's going through the same thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so important to also, if you can befriend people that are at different stages to you, it's quite handy, because if you know someone that's kind of almost a year ahead of where you are, you can say like, what's it like to go through this? Or and they know, usually they know the answers. So yeah, obviously community is just so important. And what an incredible opportunity that was for you. I know you've documented your kind of journey to publication on your Instagram, which I will link to in the show notes, but I'd love if you could, for the benefit of the podcast, tell us kind of how you got from finishing your novel to getting your book deal.
So I started writing The Revels during lockdown, and so by so I started in 2020, and then by December 2020 I had my first line, because it's like I was procrastinating so much with like research and finding that good opening. And then I applied for the Claire McIntosh Scholarship, run by, like, you know, Curtis Brown, Creative. And so I got into that the following year. It was a 6-month course, so it started in February 2021. My math is going to be off, so I think it finished in July, I guess. I'm terrible at maths, just as a disclaimer. And then while I was on the course as well, I entered the HarperCollins inaugural Killing It Prize for Undiscovered Writers. And I was notified in August that I was one of 3 winners. And so as part of the award, you got like a free manuscript assessment, and that was by, you know, Phoebe Morgan, who's both an amazing editor and a brilliant kind of crime author as well. And it's like, I remember getting the email and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then it was kind of like, but I don't have a full manuscript yet. So it's like, I had about 3 days or 4 days, and it's like, yes, I had to finish that manuscript. And I think I wrote about, oh God, maybe like 20,000 words to finish it off. And so it's just that thing, I felt like a vampire after I hit the send button. But I feel like with that competition, like, it really kind of just helped me to finish it, because I feel like sometimes, like, I'm a slow writer, like, if I can procrastinate, like, I will. And so having that deadline really kind of pushed me, so that by October 2021, I started to query agents, and then when I met Liza, I just knew from that meeting that she was the best editor for me. So in a way, it happened really, really kind of quickly. But then I feel like having that kind of experience of failure with my first book, it kind of prepared me. And then I was just lucky because everything seemed to kind of align for the second book. So yeah.
I wondered then whether, from your experience of your publication, whether you had any advice for next year's debuts, so the
Oh
2024
God, yeah.
debuts. Is there anything you wished you'd known before you signed your contract and your book deal?
Oh, I feel everyone warns about the kind of, the terror of book two. So I feel you always kind of wish that, you could just be more ahead of the game and more prolific. But then it's sort of that thing, it's like, if you'd written that book kind of earlier, would it be the same book, that kind of thing. So it's sort of it's always right time, right place. But then I feel like my kind of, advice for book two, and what I realize is kind of just having a better sense of balance. So just kind of trying to sort of see what the year ahead is going to look like, to kind of really plan out your time so that, you're not kind of doing too much and risking burning out. And then I also feel as well, another thing I would have, because obviously when you get close to publication, you're sometimes you're you're you might, if you're lucky, be able to do kind of interviews or podcasts or write feature pieces or short stories. And so I had that, and then it was just like being there, brilliant. But then it's like it is like such a it's it can just be quite time consuming. So I feel like for publication, definitely just try to clear your schedule so that you're not kind of going back and forth between things, because sometimes publishers will throw stuff at you, and then of course you'll want to say yes, and then you're just like, oh God, I don't have enough time. And then I also just feel like kind of just be kind to yourself as well, because obviously when you look on social media, you can see that everyone is a lot more you can feel like you're in that thing where you're behind, you're finishing, you're coming in last, or you're behind everyone else. And it's not the case. Everyone moves at their own pace, and just to kind of prioritize the writing, and then also to enjoy it, because you only get to be a debut kind of once. And then I feel like, yeah, once you're done being a debut, I feel like everyone kind of expects you to kind of be like an expert in a way. So definitely enjoy being like a debut. And but I also feel like regardless of what stage you're at, just ask questions. If you have a question, even if it's with editing or whatever, just ask, because sometimes people forget that you're new. So anything you're unsure of, just ask.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. Once you've done being a debut, who cares? No, I'm joking. So we've talked about book two, the fear of book two, difficulties surrounding book two. So Stacey, now it's time. Finally, please tease us, give us a little reveal of what you're writing next.
So book two, it's set in London 1950, so very different to the 17th century. But basically, it's set in 1958, so the last year that debutantes curtsy to the Queen. So it's all about the people behind the debutantes, from the ambitious mothers who will do everything to make their daughters deb of the year, to the social secretaries who see their debs as a way to kind of get an in into high society. And then what happens when the Queen is like, oh, the Queen is like, we're done with high society. I mean, not done with high society, but we're done with the curtsying. So it's like that very kind of elite exclusive world is getting smaller. And so your way to kind of get an entry into that world, it's kind of like it's starting to disappear unless you already belong. So yes, and as per my USP, like a kind of an element of the supernatural in a way.
Yeah, you've got to include that now, Stacey. That's your brand. That's your thing.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds really different from your first book and very exciting. And I know how passionate and enthusiastic you get about your different eras when you're working on your novel. So I'm sure it'll be brilliant. Stacey, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me, Chloe.
That was Stacey Thomas. talking about her historical novel, The Revels, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.